Chapter 51. I meet an old acquaintance in Flanders, and find my mother's grave and my own cradle there. Being one day in the church of St. Gudule, at Brussels, admiring the antique splendor of the architecture, and always entertaining a great tenderness and reverence for the mother church, that hath been as wickedly persecuted in England as ever she herself persecuted in the days of her prosperity, Esmond saw kneeling at a side altar an officer in a green uniform coat, very deeply engaged in devotion. Something familiar in the figure and posture of the kneeling man struck Captain Esmond, even before he saw the officer's face. As he rose up, putting away into his pocket a little black breviary, such as priests use, Esmond beheld a countenance so like that of his friend and tutor of early days, Father Holt, that he broke out into an exclamation of astonishment, and advanced a step towards the gentleman, who was making his way out of church. The German officer too looked surprised when he saw Esmond, and his face from being pale grew suddenly red. By this mark of recognition, the Englishman knew that he could not be mistaken, and though the other did not stop, but on the contrary rather hastily walked away towards the door, Esmond pursued him, and faced him once more, as the officer, helping himself to holy water, turned mechanically towards the altar, to bow to it ere he quitted the sacred edifice. "My father," says Esmond in English. "Silence. I do not understand. I do not speak English," says the other in Latin. Esmond smiled at this sign of confusion, and replied in the same language, "Should know my father in any garment, black or white, shaven or bearded." For the Austrian officer was habited quite in the military manner, and had as warlike a mustachio as any pander. He laughed. We were on the church steps by this time, passing through the crowd of beggars, that usually is there holding up little trinkets for sale and whining for alms. "Who speak Latin," says he, in the English way, "Harry Esmond, you have forsaken the old true Roman tongue you once knew." His tone was very frank, and friendly quite, the kind voice of 15 years back. He gave Esmond his hand as he spoke. "Others have changed their coats too, my father," says Esmond, glancing at his friend's military decoration. "Hush! I am Mr. or Captain von Holtz, in the Bavarian Elector's service, and on a mission to His Highness the Prince of Savoy. You can keep a secret I know from old times." "Captain von Holtz," says Esmond, "I am your very humble servant." "And you too have changed your coat," continues the other in his laughing way. "I have heard of you at Cambridge and afterwards. We have friends everywhere, and I am told that Mr. Esmond at Cambridge was as good a fencer as he was a bad theologian." "So," thinks Esmond, "my old mater d'armes was a Jesuit, as they said." "Perhaps you are right," says the other, reading his thoughts quite as he used to do in old days. "You were all but killed at Hochstedt of a wound in the left side. You were before that at Vigo, aide-de-camp to the Duke of Ormond. You got your company the other day after Ramillies. Your general and the Prince Duke are not friends. He is of the webs of Lydiard Tregas, in the county of York, a relation of my Lord St. John. Your cousin, M. de Castlewood, served his first campaign this year in the Guard. Yes, I do know a few things, as you see." Captain Esmond laughed in his turn. "Who have indeed a curious knowledge," he says. "A foible of Mr. Holt's, who did know more about books and men than, perhaps, almost any person Esmond had ever met, was omniscience. Thus in every point he here professed to know, he was nearly right, but not quite. Esmond's wound was in the right side, not the left. His first general was General Lumley. Mr. Webb came out of Wiltshire, not out of Yorkshire, and so forth." Esmond did not think fit to correct his old master in these trifling blunders, but they served to give him a knowledge of the other's character, and he smiled to think that this was his oracle of early days, only now no longer infallible or divine. "Yes," continues Father Holt, or Captain von Holtz, "for a man who has not been in England these 8 years, I know what goes on in London very well. The old dean is dead, my Lady Castlewood's father, Do you know that the recusant bishops wanted to consecrate a bishop of Southampton, and that Collier is bishop of Thetford by the same imposition? The Princess Anne has the gout and eats too much. When the king returns, Collier will be an archbishop. Amen, says Esmond, laughing, and I hope to see your eminence no longer in jackboots, but red stockings, at Whitehall. You are always with us. I know that I heard of that when you were at Cambridge. So was the late lord. So is the young viscount. And so was my father before me, said Mr. Esmond, looking calmly at the other, who did not, however, show the least sign of intelligence in his impenetrable gray eyes. How well Harry remembered them and their look. Only crow's feet were wrinkled round the marks of black old time but settled there. Esmond's face chose to show no more sign of meaning than the father's. There may have been on the one side, and the other just the faintest glitter of recognition, as you see a bayonet shining out of an ambush, but each party fell back, when everything was again dark. And you, mon capitain, where have you been? Says Esmond, turning away the conversation from this dangerous ground, where neither chose to engage. I may have been in Pekin, says he, or I may have been in Paraguay, who knows where. I am now Captain von Holtz, in the service of his Electoral Highness, come to negotiate exchange of prisoners with his Highness of Savoy. 'Twas well known that very many officers in our army were well affected towards the young king at St. Germain's, whose right to the throne was undeniable, and whose accession to it, at the death of his sister, by far the greater part of the English people would have preferred, to the having a petty German prince for a sovereign, about whose cruelty, rapacity, boorish manners, and odious foreign ways, a thousand stories were current. It wounded our English pride to think that a shabby high Dutch duke, whose revenues were not a tithe as great as those of many of the princes of our ancient English nobility, who could not speak a word of our language, and whom we chose to represent as a sort of German boor, feeding on train oil and sauerkraut, with a bevy of mistresses in a barn, should come to reign over the proudest and most polished people in the world. Were we, the conquerors of the Grand Monarch, to submit to that ignoble domination? What did the Hanoverians' Protestantism matter to us? Was it not notorious, we were told and led to believe, so, that one of the daughters of this Protestant hero was being bred up with no religion at all, as yet, and ready to be made Lutheran or Roman, according as the husband might be whom her parents should find for her? This talk, very idle and abusive much of it was, went on at 100 mess tables in the army. There was scarce an ensign that did not hear it, or join in it, and everybody knew, or affected to know, that the commander-in-chief himself had relations with his nephew, the Duke of Berwick. 'Twas by an Englishman, thank God, that we were beaten at Almanza, and that his grace was most anxious to restore the royal race of his benefactors, and to repair his former treason. This is certain, that for a considerable period no officer in the Duke's army lost favor with the commander-in-chief for entertaining or proclaiming his loyalty towards the exiled family. When the Chevalier de St. George, as the King of England called himself, came with the Dukes of the French blood royal to join the French army under Vendisme, hundreds of ours saw him and cheered him, and we all said he was like his father in this, who, seeing the action of La Hogue fought between the French ships and ours, was on the side of his native country during the battle. But this, at least the Chevalier knew, and everyone knew, that, however well our troops and their general might be inclined towards the prince personally, in the face of the enemy there was no question at all. Wherever my Lord Duke found a French army, he would fight and beat it, as he did at Oudenarde, 2 years after Ramillies, where his grace achieved another of his transcendent victories. And the noble young prince, who charged gallantly along with the magnificent Mason Duroy, sent to compliment his conquerors after the action. in this battle, where the young electoral prince of Hanover behaved himself very gallantly, fighting on our side. Esmond's dear General Webb distinguished himself prodigiously, exhibiting consummate skill and coolness as a general, and fighting with the personal bravery of a common soldier. Esmond's good luck again attended him. He escaped without a hurt, although more than a third of his regiment was killed, had again the honor to be favorably mentioned in his commander's report, and was advanced to the rank of major. But of this action there is little need to speak, as it hath been related in every gazette, and talked of in every hamlet in this country. To return from it to the writer's private affairs, which here, in his old age, and at a distance, he narrates for his children who come after him. Before Oudenarde, after that chance encounter with Captain von Holtz at Brussels, a space of more than a year lapsed, during which the captain of Jesuits and the captain of Webb's Fusiliers were thrown very much together. Esmond had no difficulty in finding out, indeed, the other made no secret of it to him, being assured from old times of his pupil's fidelity that the negotiator of prisoners was an agent from St. Germain's, and that he carried intelligence between great personages in our camp and that of the French. "Why, business," said he, "and I tell you, both because I can trust you, and your keen eyes have already discovered it is between the King of England and his subjects here engaged in fighting the French king. As between you and them, all the Jesuits in the world will not prevent your quarreling. Fight it out, gentlemen. St. George for England, I say, and you know who says so, wherever he may be. I think Holt loved to make a parade of mystery, as it were, and would appear and disappear at our quarters as suddenly as he used to return, and vanish in the old days at Castlewood. He had passes between both armies, and seemed to know, but with that inaccuracy which belonged to the good father's omniscience, equally well, what passed in the French camp and in ours. One day he would give Esmond news of a great feast that took place in the French quarters, of a supper of Monsieur de Rohan's, where there was play and violins, and then dancing and masks. The king drove thither in Marshal Villars' own guinguette. Another day he had the news of His Majesty's again. The king had not had a fit these 10 days, and might be said to be well. Captain Holtz made a visit to England during this time, so eager was he about negotiating prisoners, and 'twas on returning from this voyage that he began to open himself more to Esmond, and to make him, as occasion served, at their various meetings, several of those confidences which are here set down altogether. The reason of his increased confidence was this. Upon going to London, the old director of Esmond's aunt, the Dowager, paid her ladyship a visit at Chelsea, and there learnt from her that Captain Esmond was acquainted with the secret of his family, and was determined never to divulge it. The knowledge of this fact raised Esmond in his old tutor's eyes, so Holt was pleased to say, and he admired Harry very much for his abnegation. "The family at Castlewood have done far more for me than my own ever did," Esmond said. "Would give my life for them. Why should I grudge the only benefit that is in my power to confer on them?" The good father's eyes filled with tears at this speech, which to the other seemed very simple. He embraced Esmond, and broke out into many admiring expressions. He said he was a noble cœur, that he was proud of him, and fond of him as his pupil and friend, regretted more than ever that he had lost him, and been forced to leave him in those early times, when he might have had an influence over him, have brought him into that only true church to which the father belonged, and enlisted him in the noblest army in which a man ever engaged, meaning his own Society of Jesus, which numbers, says he, in its troops the greatest heroes the world ever knew, warriors brave enough to dare endure anything, to encounter any odds, to die any death, soldiers that of one triumph say 1,000 times more brilliant than those of the greatest general, that have brought nations on their knees to their sacred banner, the cross, that have achieved glories and palms incomparably brighter than those awarded to the most splendid earthly conquerors, crowns of immortal light, and seats in the high places of heaven. Esmond was thankful for his old friend's good opinion, however little he might share the Jesuit father's enthusiasm. "Have thought of that question too," says he, "dear father," and he took the other's hand, thought it out for myself, as all men must, and contrive to do the right, and trust to heaven as devoutly in my way as you in yours. Another 6 months of you as a child, and I had desired no better. I used to weep upon my pillow at Castlewood as I thought of you, and I might have been a brother of your order, and who knows," Esmond added, with a smile, "a priest in full orders, and with a pair of mustachios, and a Bavarian uniform." "My son," says Father Holt, turning red, "in the cause of religion and loyalty all disguises are fair." "Yes," broke in Esmond, "all disguises are fair, you say, and all uniforms, say I, black or red, a black cockade or a white one or a laced hat, or a sombrero, with a tonsure under it. I cannot believe that St. Francis Xavier sailed over the sea in a cloak, or raised the dead. I tried, and very nearly did once, but cannot. Suffer me to do the right, and to hope for the best in my own way." Esmond wished to cut short the good father's theology, and succeeded. And the other, sighing over his pupil's invincible ignorance, did not withdraw his affection from him, but gave him his utmost confidence as much, that is to say, as a priest can give. More than most do, for he was naturally garrulous, and too eager to speak. Holt's friendship encouraged Captain Esmond to ask, what he long wished to know, and none could tell him, some history of the poor mother whom he had often imagined in his dreams, and whom he never knew. He described to Holt those circumstances which are already put down in the first part of this story, the promise he had made to his dear Lord, and that dying friend's confession, and he besought Mr. Holt to tell him what he knew regarding the poor woman from whom he had been taken. "She was of this very town," Holt said, "and took Esmond to see the street where her father lived, and where, as he believed, she was born. In 1676, when your father came hither in the retinue of the late king, then Duke of York, and banished hither in disgrace, Captain Thomas Esmond became acquainted with your mother, pursued her, and made a victim of her. He hath told me in many subsequent conversations, which I felt bound to keep private then, that she was a woman of great virtue and tenderness, and in all respects a most fond, faithful creature. He called himself Captain Thomas, having good reason to be ashamed of his conduct towards her, and hath spoken to me many times with sincere remorse for that, as with fond love for her many amiable qualities, he owned to having treated her very ill, and that at this time his life was one of profligacy, gambling, and poverty. She became with child of you, was cursed by her own parents at that discovery, though she never upbraided, except by her involuntary tears, and the misery depicted on her countenance, the author of her wretchedness and ruin. Thomas Esmond, Captain Thomas, as he was called, became engaged in a gaming house brawl, of which the consequence was a duel, and a wound so severe, that he never, his surgeon said, could outlive it. Thinking his death certain, and touched with remorse, he sent for a priest of the very church of St. Gudule where I met you, and on the Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.